Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson, and once again, impeachment really dominating the national conversation. And this week, we are talking to the man at the center of the entire impeachment story. We're talking about Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat from Burbank, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the guy leading the charge. He's going to be leading the first public impeachment hearings next week. Nancy Pelosi has basically said, Adam Schiff, take the ball and run. So we talk to him. We also talk about impeachment and more with our panel this week, John Thomas, Republican strategist, Jessica Levinson, a law professor at Loyola Law School, and Gustavo Arellano making his first appearance from the LA Times. Interesting conversation about Prop 187. But let's begin with that big discussion of the week, Adam Schiff and impeachment. Congressman Schiff, welcome back to The Issue Is. You were our first guest on our first show, and we will always be grateful for that.
Thanks.
So we have these hearings next week. Republicans are asking for public hearings. You've announced that on Wednesday we've got William Taylor and George Kent. On Friday, Marie Yovanovitch. Most Americans have never heard of those people before the last couple weeks. Who are they? Why do we care about them? And why are you picking them first?
Well, Marie Yovanovitch was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and she was the victim of a vicious smear campaign that was led by Rudy Giuliani and some of his allies in an effort to force her out of that position. Ultimately, she was recalled, and her successor, the chargé d'affaires, is Ambassador Taylor, who the public will also hear from next week. He would become the top person in Ukraine. The top person in Washington with the portfolio of Ukraine was DAS, or Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, who the public will also hear from next week. So you'll hear from the two top people on the ground in Ukraine, and you'll hear from the top person with that portfolio in Washington, D.C. And what they will describe, I think, is pretty consistent and consistently shocking, and that is that you had a regular foreign policy channel led by the career diplomats, and you had an irregular channel in which the president, Rudy Giuliani, and someone named Ambassador Sondland sought to get the Ukrainians to do political investigations that would help the president in his reelection campaign, and sought to coerce Ukraine into doing it by holding up hundreds of millions of dollars in military assistance they needed to fight off the Russians, and a meeting that the president of Ukraine desperately wanted at the White House with President Trump. So I think these three witnesses will lay out the broad story, the broad arc of the events of the last year, and chronicle much of the president's flagrant abuse of his office.
You know, Republicans have expressed a lot of frustration with you. The president calls you Shifty Shift. He says that you're a liar. The colleague, Kevin McCarthy, who's the top Republican in the House, he was on CBS's Face the Nation, and he was asked who he would want to call in an impeachment hearing, and he said you. Here's what he had to say, and then we'll get you to respond.
Well, I think the very first person we should bring, Adam Schiff and his staff. He is the only individual in America
for a public
Congress
hearing
who knows.
You want to question
the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee? Yes, I would, because he is the only person who knows who this whistleblower is. He refers to himself as a Ken Starr. Ken Starr testified. How many times did he meet with the whistleblower? What did he talk to the whistleblower about? Because when the whistleblower even went to the inspector general, he never mentioned that he went with Adam Schiff.
So what's your response to that? And what was the nature of your relationship with the whistleblower before all of this?
Well, literally probably a dozen false statements. I couldn't keep track as I was listening to the clip by Kevin McCarthy. I've never met the whistleblower. I don't know who the whistleblower is. But you have to understand one thing about Kevin McCarthy. He has no independent judgment. He is merely the vessel for the president to act in the Congress. He does whatever the president wants, and he says whatever the president says. And that's, you know, really, I think, a shame that you have a party leader in Congress so willing to debase themselves to this unethical president, but that's exactly what Kevin McCarthy does.
So you say you've never met the whistleblower at all. Do you know who the whistleblower is, though? You know the whistleblower's identity, right?
I do not know. So all those statements you heard from Mr. McCarthy are just flat out false and wrong, but that's the kind of person Kevin McCarthy is, I'm afraid.
Wow. Okay, so what do you make, though, of the president's son and other Republicans now naming a person that they believe to be the whistleblower?
Well, look, there's been an effort by the Republicans, by the president and others to out this whistleblower, to punish this whistleblower, to bring about political retribution against this whistleblower. It's shameful. It's shameful. You have the president talking about how people that blow the whistle should be treated as we used to treat traitors and spies. That is, we used to give them the death penalty. So this is an attack on accountability. Now, you can understand why the president wants to attack the whistleblower. He feels it's his God-given right to abuse his office in any way he wants, and anyone who essentially calls out that wrongdoing is a traitor, because he believes he is the state. That may be true of a monarchy, it is not true of the United States of America.
So we're less than a year away from the election now. Why not just let voters decide this? What's the point of doing this when there is no indication at all that 20 Republican senators are willing to convict the president?
Well, here's the problem, Alex. On the day after Bob Mueller came and testified before Congress, on the day after Bob Mueller set out how Donald Trump and the Trump campaign invited Russian interference in our election, made use of it in their campaign plan, lied about it, covered it up, and then obstructed the investigation into that misconduct, on the day after his testimony, Donald Trump was back on the phone, this time with a different world leader, this time with President Zelensky of Ukraine, seeking to have Ukraine interfere in the next election. Clearly, the lesson this president walked away from the whole Mueller investigation was he can't be indicted, he can't be impeached, he is above the law, he is above any accountability. And to leave a president with the idea, an unethical president with the idea that they are above the law is just too dangerous a prospect for the country.
I have a question just about you as a human being, right? Even getting away from the politics. You've got half the country or 30% of the country saying negative things about you, calling you a liar, talking about you in social media. You've got the president of the United States bashing you almost every single day. On a human level, what does that feel like? And how do you deal with that?
Well, look, you know, I think, honestly, standing up to this president, calling out misconduct by the president or people around him is part of my duty, and I'm willing to take whatever comes with that. I just wish that my Republican colleagues had the courage to stand up to him also. This shouldn't be a partisan issue. It should be an issue about what's right for America, what kind of conduct we should expect in the president of the United States. This shouldn't be an issue of loyalty to party. This ought to be an issue of loyalty to country. But I realize, look, the president has got to go after me. He doesn't have Bob Mueller to go after. His acolytes are going to go after me. And so that segment that watches nothing but Fox primetime, yes, they're going to have antipathy towards me. But I rest well knowing that when this chapter of history is written, it will reserve its most damning language for those that defended the actions of this immoral president of the United States.
And one more question. You're working so hard. The reports are you're like barely sleeping. What do you do to relax? How do you get away from this? How do you get a break? What do you do for fun?
Well, first of all, the rumors of my not getting enough sleep have less to do with not being able to sleep, more to do with just the schedule, but I get plenty of sleep, I'll have you know. In terms of what I do to relax, you know, I still just like going out to dinner and the movies with my family. I love going to the gym and working out, and that's going to be probably about it in terms of my recreation, at least for the near future.
You can only imagine the stress that Adam Schiff must be under, and will only get more stressful next week as those impeachment hearings begin. Our thanks to him for joining us once again from Washington. And, you know, we've reached out over and over again to his Republican colleagues, offering them the chance to talk to us and to talk to their constituents back home. And we hope that they will soon take us up on our offer. Now to our panel. This week we have joining us John Thomas, Republican strategist, TPS Strategies. He is also all the time on cable news, and he's got a podcast called The Thomas Guide. Jessica Levinson, a law professor at Loyola Law School, who you see all over the place on TV and a regular guest on our show. And for the first time on our show, Gustavo Arellano. He's a columnist at the LA Times. For years he was at OC Weekly. He's got a new podcast about Prop 187. Let's talk about that in a moment, but let's begin, though, with a conversation about impeachment and a reaction to what we all just heard when it comes to Congressman Adam Schiff. Let's begin with John.
I mean, look, it's become a circus, and I think Adam Schiff likes it and the Democrats like it, because the longer that they can create this cloud of controversy, stretch this thing out, they keep the president's approval ratings down and the president off message, off his reelection message of other things. So it was interesting to hear Schiff's response that despite there being zero path to actually get this confirmed in the Senate, instead of just censuring the president, going on record in the House, he's going to continue to go down this road. It's purely political, and that's the problem.
What do you make of him saying that Kevin McCarthy is essentially making stuff up about what he said, conversations he's had with this whistleblower, calling him out in a way I've never really heard him call anybody out
before?
Yeah,
it was interesting how he talked about McCarthy, but look, I think McCarthy's point about who the whistleblower is, did Adam Schiff or any of his staff have any, the relationship, how did the whistleblower draft his remarks, all of that I think is relevant information. Obviously, Congressman Schiff doesn't want to have that conversation, so he's resorted to discrediting the questioner.
Well, he's saying that it didn't happen. I mean, that's a different, isn't that a different tactic? What did you make of that?
Well, this is going to shock you. I totally disagree with what you said. So, number one, I actually think this is terrible for Democrats that this is dragging on, because then the president can continue to say, why aren't House Democrats doing the work of the American people? Why do they keep this witch hunt going? And I think Democrats know that, and that's why they decided not to go to court for every time somebody ignores a subpoena. The other thing about, you know, why are we going through this impeachment? Why not just censure, as you said? Because impeachment is in the Constitution. And if we still live in a government that is structured by the Constitution, then that word has got to mean
something. So you're willing to shut down the government, get no progress done on the important things that Democrats ran in on the midterms, so that you can put a stamp on the Constitution. Great.
I don't think we have to shut down the government. I think what you have to do is say, either we respect that term, and if we see this type of behavior that rises to impeachable offenses, we do it, or that term impeachment becomes meaningless.
Gustavo, what do you think?
I'm so tired of this impeachment talk. And I, you know, if Trump did something wrong, if the Democrats think that they did something wrong, it's time to bring out the evidence. It's time to do all the hearings or whatnot. And same thing, if Trump's innocent, then he shouldn't be crying and whining and talking witch hunt and fake news. Just get on with the program. Americans are getting sick and tired of it, and both sides are using it to their own advantage for their constituents, and no one is in the middle actually saying, like, okay, let's all unite again.
So around the table, yes or no, do we believe that President Trump will be impeached in the House?
I think so, absolutely. Yeah,
without a question.
And does anybody think that President Trump will be convicted in the Senate?
No
impossible.
Way.
Okay. Now let's talk about the presidential race itself. Apparently getting another billionaire in this. Check out the net worth from Forbes. Mike Bloomberg at $52 billion. Donald Trump at $3.1 billion. Tom Steyer at $1.6 billion. They're all apparently running for president. What do we make of Jessica, of Mike Bloomberg's presidential run?
Well, I think we're really going to know what to make of it once we know who the Democratic nominee is, because then we will know exactly who he's pulling from. I think that, you know, I think he just couldn't help himself. I mean, I think that he saw the candidate, he saw the political landscape, and he felt like he had to jump in.
But could it be him? Could he be the Democratic nominee?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that if you look at our system of government, if you look at the fact that we really have a two-party structure, the third-party candidates...
But he's running as a Democrat.
He's running as a Democrat.
Excuse me. So I would say the kind of spoilers who walk in, I don't think that they win. So is he going to, you know, be able to take this? I don't see it.
Gustavo, your friends and family, would they support Mike Bloomberg?
No, they don't care who Mike Bloomberg is. I care about him because I like Bloomberg News. That's it. Other than he's a billionaire, I don't care. He's not going to... I think the Democrats need a messiah, someone that people are going to rally around. And the problem that we're going through right now with this primary is that different people are being trotted out as a messiah, and none of them seem to be sticking. Not yet, at least. And Bloomberg's not going to be it.
You study the polls. What do you make of Bloomberg's chances?
Actually, I think he has a path, but I don't think he's going to be the nominee. There are two real impacts of this. First is this is a great news for Elizabeth Warren. She has wanted to run against Wall Street since day one. Now you've got this mega Wall Street character. And the other is Joe Biden is having a terrible day. As Joe Biden was beginning to fall anyway, this is kind of the kiss of death, because Bloomberg can come in. He checks the boxes that the left needs to hear. He's good on guns. He's good on climate change. And he can just own that lane that Biden wanted to own. So I think that's the real impact. Can he win the nomination? We'll see.
Yeah.
So I think the problem we see historically with candidates who come in late and are self-funding is that they never built that initial infrastructure. They never had that grassroots support. Yeah. And that's what Elizabeth Warren has been doing essentially for years is, and her whole message is against big money, look at all the small donors I have. And there's very few moments where we can point to a self-funding billionaire who, even though they say, I'm not going to be beholden to anyone, they also haven't built that
network. What about Donald Trump?
Yeah, that's Trump.
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He was a self-funding billionaire who had almost no organization. That was part of the problem with the whole Russia thing.
Absolutely, but I would say we can point to a couple of candidates throughout all the history of all the self-funding candidates on the local, state, and national level. The other thing is, Donald Trump, I mean, that was a weird election, and look, did Hillary Clinton lose or did Donald Trump win?
Yeah, I mean, and he was a reality star that everybody knew, too, had almost 100% name ID when he came in.
And let's not forget, Trump locked on to the intensity in the Republican primary on building that wall in immigration.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren's owning the intensity lane right now, and I don't know that Bloomberg can really be there.
And Bernie Sanders raising a lot of money from small donors as well.
Clearly, I do not have enough money to get into this presidential race. It'll be interesting to see what one more billionaire does. Now to our next conversation. It's about Prop 187. 25 years ago today, California passed this proposition, which essentially meant that you couldn't give any benefits to illegal immigrants in the state. If they went to public schools, they had to show papers. If they went to the doctor, they had to show papers. It passed 60% of the vote. Never was implemented. It was thrown out in court. But it really changed politics in this state. And Republicans, Latinos became activated, realized that they had to get involved politically, and ended up voting out Republicans. We have not really had statewide Republicans win since, with the possible exception of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, you know, some people would doubt how much he was even a Republican. So Gustavo Arellano's made a whole podcast about that, and we started the conversation with him about Prop 187.
Sort of the big takeaway, because I think there's a lot of people watching that may not even remember Prop 187, or maybe weren't alive for that, how that really continues to shape California.
This one proposition that 59% of California voters approved in 1994 went on to turn California into the bluer than indigo state that we're at in Sacramento, but also paved the way for Donald Trump to enter the White House using anti-immigrant rhetoric.
And how did it do that?
Talk about, sum it up. They did it because, well, on the one hand, you had a generation of Latino voters who saw all the, you know, the rhetoric used ostensibly about illegal immigration, but really coming off in xenophobic tones and saying, hey, you Republicans are going against my dad, against myself, against my uncles. I'm not going to go vote for Republicans ever again in California. On the other hand, the rest of the United States, anti-immigrant activists said, hey, if 187 passed so well, let's start replicating it in our states as well.
John, you run campaigns for a living. You look at the polling among Latinos in this state. You know the challenge for Republicans in this state. How much has this hurt Republicans, and how do Republicans sort of move on from it?
Well, it was poison at the time because it activated a demographic of voters voting is a habitual thing. Once you start doing it, you don't stop. So it ignited, perhaps some say accelerated, a trend that might have already been coming as demographic shifts. And Republicans haven't recovered since. I think the conversation has to be shifted. We can have a conversation about illegal immigration in the border in California. Look, 77% of voters in Orange County, for instance, believe we have a crisis at the border. But the solution is not to demonize them. The solution is to deal with it.
Jessica, the argument that Gavin Newsom has made on this show is essentially Prop 187 is a preview of what's to come for the whole country. Because as the rest of the country becomes more Latino and less white, you could have a place like Texas turn blue, and then all of a sudden Republicans have a hard time ever winning nationally again. Do you see something like that coming?
I think it's possible. So, again, you have to look at the demographics in these states. Now, Texas is not going to be blue next year or even next decade necessarily. But if you look at what's happening on a lot of the western states, the populations that are growing, the populations that are decreasing, frankly, I mean, I think the Republican Party is not, I'm sorry, coming back in California. And I think that we could see, you know, that old saying, you know, as goes California, then the rest of the nation will go. But it's not necessarily the case that groups vote like monoliths or that any minority is just going to be a Democrat. So you have to look at which specific groups are growing in which states.
And Gustavo, I know you feel that a lot of Latinos actually identify in a lot of ways with the Republicans, especially social conservatives, right?
It didn't have to be this way. President Reagan passed the 86th amnesty. You had for a couple years, my parents, they liked Ronald Reagan, like, hey, he gave us amnesty. And then Republicans in California threw away all that goodwill with 187, and Trump is doing the same on a nationwide level with second-generation Latinos. He knows with his rhetoric.
Well, it is a really, really interesting podcast, and I hope everybody listens to it.
From Prop 187 to something that is being discussed in Las Vegas, they passed an ordinance that makes it illegal to sleep on the street if there are open shelter beds in some of the city shelters. Is this legal? Is this potentially a model for California? Let's talk about it with our panel, Gustavo Arellano, John Thomas, but let's begin with Jessica Levinson.
Is this legal?
So we don't know it yet. This is a great law professor answer, right? We have one case to look at. The Ninth Circuit ruled on a similar law that came out of Boise, Idaho. But in that case, it said you can't live on the street, period. And it didn't have the contingency that this law has, which says if there are beds that you could go to. And so the Ninth Circuit threw it out and they said it's overbroad. You have to make sure that there are places people can go. This law was written specifically in response to that, saying, okay, only if there's some place that people can sleep. It kind of depends on who the judges are who look at this. It's obviously politically charged. The Ninth Circuit in the previous case dealing with Idaho said it was cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment. This one is a lot more narrowly tailored, so it could survive.
What do we think? Is this a good idea, though?
Yeah, I mean, it beats what we're doing now, because the problem is you have people that are setting up permanent homes. This is not like, oh, I'm just going to spend the night on the street here. I mean, these are permanent encampments that people are building, and it only festers and grows. So the theory that, you know, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here, actually beats a sharp stick in the eye, because right now we're building out all these services, they're underutilized, and the homelessness problem only continues to grow.
Although part of the penalty for this is that you get a $1,000 fine. How are these people supposed to pay that?
It's whack-a-mole. So, okay, they're not going to be able to live in downtown Las Vegas. They're going to go next to Henderson. And after Henderson, they're going to go to Baker. And after that, like, it's every, and what's going to happen now, every city's going to pass it one by one, especially if it holds up. Where are all these people going to end up? There's not going to be any solving of the homelessness.
Because, yeah, you've got to fix the underlying problem of homelessness.
You need mental health, drug addiction, all that stuff. In California,
you've got to reduce the cost of living, cost of housing. I mean, it's a whole, I would argue, reduce taxes so that people can afford to actually invest in housing.
I was waiting for the moment when we disagreed. Right. I was thinking, yes, there are so many
components to this problem. That's the challenge. Just one law alone is not going to do it.
Yeah.
It's a back-end solution. So you need to solve the front end, which is why is this happening in the first place. You don't want to see the patient who could have had a Band-Aid, but now you have to perform surgery. You want to take the preventative measures.
But though, Gustavo, there is an appetite in this state to do something right now.
Of course, that's what I'm saying. Every single municipality is going to be looking at this and going to try to pass some of those. And we're talking even the quote-unquote nicer municipalities like Los Angeles, like Berkeley, to places that have the bigger homeless populations. Now you get cities like, say, Huntington Beach, Escondido. All municipalities in Southern California seem to have a homeless issue now. And so the not nicer ones, they're going to even try even harder things.
Okay, well, we're excited that the nice and not so nice people watched us today. Thank you for watching us this week.
Our thanks to our panel for joining us this week. Gustavo Arellano, we sat down for a podcast extra, which you can download right now here at the Issue Is podcast. It's really fascinating. It's sort of a deep dive into Proposition 187. If you love California politics, it's really important to know this. It's kind of a foundational thing that's set up kind of everything that's happening in the state right now. And he's a great storyteller. So we hope you listen to that. We hope that you liked listening to this and that you'll give us a nice rating in the iTunes store, if that's how you're listening. And tell your friends about The Issue Is. We're trying to let people know what we're doing. We believe it's important. And we appreciate everybody being in this with us together. Hope you have a great, great week, and we will see you next week. Next week, a bunch of the candidates are all going to be here. It's a big California Democratic convention here next week, so you're going to see a lot of presidential candidates returning to California. We hope to talk to them next week here on The Issue Is. Thanks for listening.